different Israeli government, slightly more moderate, certainly including non-Netanyahu figures. And in that moment, the U.S. did not, try to pursue any kind of progress, right? President Biden didn't even reverse policies that President Trump had imposed that were anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. So to me, the thing that needs to be questioned in this moment, certainly Netanyahu, personally corrupt, attempting to hold on to power for as long as he can, but as one Israeli analyst put it, there's a, quote, culture of impunity, right, in U.S.-Israel relations. And that's what really needs to be analyzed right now. So if you think about the broader Israeli political establishment, the person who would take over if Netanyahu were to be unseated in weeks, months later this year, is someone called Benny Gantz. He's a former Israeli general. The military is understood to be a bit more pragmatic on the Palestinian issue, just from a strategic and security standpoint, than politicians are. All that said, even a Prime Minister Benny Gantz might not be willing to accept statehood, right? Might not be willing to give Palestinians security control in Gaza. So the actual culture of the U.S. and Israel, unfortunately over decades, has become one in which even these small steps towards progress are so difficult, it's like pulling teeth. And I just draw people back to the last few examples of effective U.S. leverage over Israel. Interestingly, they've been under Republican presidents, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush to some extent, but we haven't seen that in the last 10 or 15 years, and certainly not under Presidents Biden or really Obama.
Akbar, I wanted to talk about the level of dissent in this country and in other countries that are supporting Israel right now. You just wrote a piece about over 800 government officials in the United States and Europe that have anonymously signed a statement that their own government support for Israel is in violation of their values. If you can talk more about that. And also the level at the grassroots in the United States, right up into the White House and the State Department. In fact, let me play a clip. We interviewed Josh Paul, a high-level State Department official, when he quit. You were the one who broke the story about Josh Paul.
I just have to ask before we go, Josh Paul, we spoke to you soon after you resigned from the State Department in October. This was, of course, in the midst of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which came after the October 7th surprise attack on Israel that killed 1,200. Can you talk about the response of your colleagues at the State Department? Have others resigned in other parts of the government?
So we have seen, certainly from the UN, UN senior official Cade McIver resigned. We have not seen, to my knowledge, significant resignations within the US government, but I have heard and continue to hear from many of my former colleagues who are really trying to find what mechanisms they can use to slow this down, to change the policy. I fear that their efforts at this point continue to be in vain. I think we need to see a policy change from the top, but I know a lot of good people are continuing to make the argument.
So that's Josh Paul, who quit the State Department, and he is not the only one. And I wanted to get a sense from you, how aware is President Biden of the enormous, as our guest yesterday said, Matt Duss, incandescent kind of rage in the Democratic base, but also in high levels of the government? We just Nermeen just read headlines in Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania. Over 100 people led by Jewish Voice for Peace were arrested, demanding a ceasefire and much more. Talk about all these levels of dissent in the United States and outside and what effect it's having. Is Biden fearful that his very reelection is in jeopardy?
Absolutely, Amy. I'll start with the letter you mentioned because it's a fascinating statement. More than 800 officials in the U.S., in European institutions, in the Netherlands, France, Britain. I just heard from another European official yesterday who just signed the letter. So the numbers on that letter are just going to keep growing. It's not closed yet. I'd say the dissent is it's striking because given the initial attack, there was such deep sympathy for Israel, which is a close U.S. partner, there was such a sense of, we want to do something to help. But I think it became so clear within 3 or 4 days to people that President Biden's approach to helping Israel was not going to be measured or strategic or involve planning, consultation, all of that. It was just full tilt, whatever they want, whatever the consequences. And I think that's where you see a lot of dissent come from. It comes from moral reasons, certainly for some folks within government, for people in the Democratic base, also from strategic considerations, right? Also from the sense of, is the U.S. tearing up goodwill and shoving away the good work that we have done over years and decades, particularly after former President Trump, to reestablish America's reputation in the world, right? Is that all moot now? And I think that's only grown since October because President Biden has not been willing to shift in any tangible way. In terms of his own awareness of that, what's so striking about this moment, too, is there is a huge national security establishment here in Washington, as I know you both know. So many layers, counter-terror, State Department, Treasury. But this policy is being controlled in a group of, I would say, 20 to 30 close officials around the president, right? So what's really important to remember there is a real filtering of information. And it's indisputable, of course, President Biden is going to campaign rallies and events, and he's seeing the protesters. But to what extent is he aware that many of the actual foreign policy and national security experts within his government who are nonpartisan are opposed to this policy? I think that's a little questionable, right? Because advisors around him have their own priorities. A gentleman called Brett McGurk, the top White House Middle East official who I've reported on extensively, is really pushing that U.S.-Saudi-Israel deal, and President Biden has been going along with that. I think there's very heated debates in the president's close circle, but because especially the State Department has been so frozen out at this moment, and the way I've heard it from State Department officials is they've literally been told, we understand your concern. Why don't you try to work on another part of the world? You know, why don't you look at sort of the Pacific or Latin America? Just apply your skills there. I think that kind of dismissal of this really reasoned dissent and the response to it of listening sessions and town halls and we feel your pain. People don't want their pain to be felt. They want to see a shift. So I think you'll see even more pushback from within government, certainly from within the party base. I think one of the important things, and maybe this is how the message will get through to the president, is not necessarily from his White House national security team of Jake Sullivan, Brett McGurk, Tony Blinken, but maybe through his political contacts, right? You've seen multiple Democratic senators, Chris Van Hollen, importantly of Maryland, but many others, Chris Coons even of Delaware, who's personally close to the president. They've publicly started to say, okay, we need to see a shift from Israel. So once those lawmakers, once governors, once others who are actually elected officials start standing up, you might see a shift from the president. But right now, there's still a wariness even on those fronts. I reported yesterday that this new bipartisan border package that was unveiled had Democratic senators agreeing to defund the UN Agency for Palestinians. That's a reversal from the Biden administration's own policy, a reversal from Democrats, a triumph from Republicans. So I think as soon as elected Democrats kind of find out assertiveness, that's when you might start to see a shift from the president.
Well, we'll just be speaking to a doctor who's recently returned from Gaza, where we'll discuss what's happening with UNRWA in Gaza. Thank you so much, Akbar Shahid Ahmad, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, based in Washington, D.C. Next, we speak to an American doctor recently returned from Gaza, pediatrician Dr. Seema Jalani with the International Rescue Committee. Back in a minute.
ما عرفت النعمة انتن قولي ننتن شو عرفتن هي
Your Blessings by Sudanese singer Al-Sara, featuring Huda Asfour. We spend the rest of the hour with an American doctor who just spent 2 weeks in central Gaza. Dr. Seema Jalani is a pediatrician who volunteered in the Al-Aqsa Hospital emergency room as part of a team of doctors with the International Rescue Committee, where she's senior technical advisor and leads their emergency health responses globally. The team included doctors from both IRC and Medical Aid for Palestinians. Before she joins us, we'll play some of Dr. Jalani's voice notes that she recorded in Al-Aqsa Hospital's emergency room and also at night in the compound housing the emergency medical team.
We're in the resuscitation room at Al-Aqsa Hospital. It's a mass casualty. The site of the mass casualty was a school. Of the five casualties, four are children.
So this was.
He was injured in the first day of the war.
Yeah.
And now we're day 82.
Yeah.
And he's waiting. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
I can hear the airstrikes coming in now. It's about 2 a.m. And this is the sound of drones right outside my window and also overhead flying war airplanes, I believe. I can't sleep, so I decided to do this voice note. It's a very specific hellscape that exists here in Gaza when you're cursed enough to hear the words from a doctor that say, "Whose body part is that? Don't carry it through the halls. I don't want children seeing that." And that is a quote from one of my colleagues in the emergency room where we saw a leg being carried, a lower leg with the boot still on, the sock still on, and it was being carried through the emergency room.
We've arrived here at Al-Aqsa Hospital emergency room, and what I'm seeing here is children lying on the ground, double amputation on one child, and there are no beds available, so people are literally just on the ground seeking treatment. We've already had three parents come up to us and ask, they see the stethoscope and they ask me, "Can you come see my child? Can you come see my child?" And I'm waiting for the local doctors to come in to be able to guide us through what we need to do and do a handover. There is one child that I'm looking at, approximately 8 years old, at the lying on the ground. Next to him is a woman in a wheelchair who's waiting to be seen. The one on the ground has bandages on bilateral lower extremities going all the way up, and looks like he's been brought in overnight. We're hearing right now that it was a terrible, terrible night because of the bombing in Al-Mughazi, where the people had been told to evacuate and then subsequently were bombed. There are definitely more people here than yesterday, and yesterday was very full, so no beds available. As I said, people, there's not really room or space for us to breathe or think. There's a gentleman here that's sobbing in front of me and being comforted by maybe his son, maybe a stranger, I don't know, but he's an older gentleman with a bandage on his head who's just sitting and holding his head in his hands, crying, and head hung low. And then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 children in my line of sight right now from the corner that need medical attention urgently. One of whom is crying, a little boy around 6 or 7 years old, wiping his tears. I can't see the injuries clearly, but we'll get started to work today to see how we can support and help them through this through their tragedy. That feels very close.
You don't get to hear much whistle before it comes.
One morning, we arrived to a nurse who was quietly sobbing in the corner. His colleague had been killed the night before, and he had tried to resuscitate him in the emergency room.
He is dignified in his grief. I ask, should we leave? But instead, he just thanks us for our presence and asks us to see a few patients on his behalf. He just could not face the grueling work and the patients outside the room right now. I felt rewarded if I could be helpful to this one person in this one moment. As I was rounding, about 2 hours later, I raised my head from a patient to see him. Again, right back at work, as if nothing had happened. The next day, we see a 23-year-old patient with his lower leg blown off so badly, it's disconnected from its upper leg, floppy. I look down to plant my stethoscope on his chest, only to find him still wearing his UNRWA, or UNRWA, vest as a staff member. The only comfort I can provide him is to wipe the dried blood off his face to moisten his dry lips as he yearns for some water, quietly lifting his neck for a little more. I quieten his fear with a wet washcloth to his forehead and some whispers of sweetness, of calm. None of these interventions are morphine. He died on the floor of a Gaza emergency room with little more than my hand in his hand and a washcloth to his forehead.
Those were voice notes recorded by Dr. Seema Jalani, a senior emergency health technical advisor and pediatrician who traveled to Gaza to volunteer in the Al-Aqsa Hospital emergency room as part of a team of doctors from the IRC and Medical Aid for Palestinians. Dr. Jalani previously worked in Gaza and the West Bank in 2005 and 2015. She's also a freelance journalist who was nominated for a Peabody Award for her 2006 radio documentary, Israel and Palestine, The Human Cost of the Occupation. She joins us now from Brussels. Dr. Seema Jalani, welcome back to Democracy Now! Those were immensely haunting notes, voice notes that you made. If you could talk about your journey to Gaza in December, where you went from, how long you stayed, and what you witnessed.
We departed Cairo on December 25th as part of an emergency medical team with the IRC and Medical Aid for Palestinians in partnership. From Cairo, we arrived through the Sinai, which itself is a militarized zone, and then Al Arish, and then overnighted there, and then following that, completed the two-day journey to Rafah and crossed over into the Gaza Strip as a team, and later went to our guest house. And the drive from the Rafah border all the way up to the guest house, which should only have been a few kilometers, maybe 10 at most, maybe 7, took several hours, 2 to 3 hours, if I recall, because everyone was leaving and evacuating from the north. There were people piled into cars, vans, if they were lucky, because fuel is such a precious commodity. There were babies falling asleep. There were pets and cats and dogs and families and blankets and mattresses, any food items you can imagine, piled into donkey carts and people hanging off, trying to evacuate. It was a sea of human tragedy coming straight out of the border, straight into southern Rafah. And it was quite a harrowing scene. People that were barefoot looking for shelter, looking for garbage bags to put up tents, looking for lumber. Quite something. And I've worked in several areas of conflict. It was quite staggering.
Dr. Jalani, it must be just incredible for you to listen back to what you were saying so immediate as you whispered into your microphone, whether you were holding the hand of a dying man or with a baby or in the barracks where you were staying. The place where the doctor slept, does that even exist anymore?
Our guest house was bombed shortly after I left. And I'm not sure of, it's certainly not functional or able to be resided in. I don't know of how it looks anymore, but certainly it is, it has been bombed. Yes.
And one of the people you describe, helping on the floor of the hospital. And I was wondering if you can talk about the significance of Al-Aqsa and what does it mean for so many hospitals not to be functioning. Ted was wearing an UNRWA vest. It is the center of controversy right now. Netanyahu talks about getting rid of UNRWA the way he talks about getting rid of Hamas. Talk about the central role UNRWA plays, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about hospitals.
Well, I worked at Al-Aqsa Hospital, which was one of the last remaining hospitals in the middle part of Gaza or central Gaza. It was a lifeline hospital providing critical, critical services. And from the time that I arrived to the 2 weeks, I saw its decline. I saw the fall of a hospital before my very own eyes. And, you know, in war, we're used to talking about the fall of cities, the fall of Mosul or Saigon. And suddenly we've normalized somehow that the fall of Al-Shifa Hospital and the fall of Al-Aqsa Hospital, we've normalized the fall and complete dismantling of healthcare infrastructure, totally paramount to saving lives, not only in a war zone, but in an otherwise high-functioning, high-capacity society. And it's unconscionable that we continue to watch this unfold. In terms of UNRWA, it provides services throughout the region. I have worked in the West Bank and in Gaza. I've worked in Lebanon, in Shatila refugee camp, in Burj al Barajni. They provide schooling services. I've been to their schools. They provide health services, education. And so the thought of defunding such an organization that provides jobs, education, healthcare, other services that are not otherwise available, really is deeply disturbing. As we're now producing a generation of orphans, a generation of children with new disabilities, who will then have no access to healthcare, education, or other services that would be able to in some way help relieve some of their pain and get them back to a functioning society.
And Dr. Jilani, you have spoken about the fact that many patients may not have survived, but their pain would certainly have been eased if the proper medical supplies were made available, if minimally medication, you spoke specifically of morphine could be administered to ease their pain. I mean, if you could explain, you know, how you work under conditions where you don't have access to even minimal medical supplies and what it is that you're calling for.
Well, it's the doctors and nurses and healthcare staff of Gaza who have displayed just absolute colossal bravery in how they see their patients, many of whom haven't been paid, many of whom are themselves displaced. Four or five times over, scavenging for food, water, shelter, and then showing up to work, as I mentioned in one of those notes, strenuously to serve their communities, and then coming to a workplace that doesn't have what they need to be able to treat their patients with dignity. There is no death with dignity in Gaza on the floor of an emergency room. At the beginning of my time in Gaza, we did have access to morphine, but by the end, there was no access. And at that point, it becomes a very cruel and inhumane situation to have someone actively dying without any pain or comfort to offer them. I recall vividly a young boy that had come in not for a life-threatening injury, but for stitches because of some deep lacerations. And we would usually use ketamine in a situation like that because it's safe. And in children, it provides both pain relief and amnesia, so they're not re-traumatized from the procedure. Of course, we didn't have ketamine. And so I tried any distraction measures I could with this young boy. I have sort of flashing lights in my arsenal as a pediatrician. I have some toys. And he just was screaming through the pain. And then when I tried to ask him questions and engage him to distract him, because that's a mechanism, a coping mechanism we can use, every question is a landmine. What I would typically say in the U.S. is, who's your best friend? Well, his best friend probably or might be dead. What's your favorite food? I don't know the last time this young child ate and would probably re-traumatize him further. Are you closer to mom or dad? He came in as an orphan with only family, extended family members. There is no part or no prism or facet of their life that has been left untouched. It is completely devastated and in a cataclysmic situation.
Can you talk more about being a pediatrician in a war zone and also people seeing you as a foreigner coming in and you parts we didn't play talk about people just coming up to you and saying ceasefire?
Yeah, absolutely. People, as the days went on, more and more crowded into the hospital seeking safe shelter. And so you would see entire families perched on blankets. And so you would they would recognize us as foreigners. And their little blankets served as their bedroom, their coffee room, their breakfast room, their kitchen, just in the hopes that the hospital would keep them safe and they would see us and turn to us and see us as foreigners and say, ceasefire? Or even more heartbreakingly, so take me with you. Where can we go? Where is safe? In terms of being a pediatrician, I've worked in war zones. I've worked in refugee rescue boats off the coast of Libya. I've worked in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Egypt. I have never treated this many war-wounded children in my career. No system is built to withstand what these people are going through. On one day, as you saw, 4 out of 5 of the children whom we were actively resuscitating, which means trying to bring back from the brink of death, 4 of 5 of my patients were under the age of 15, so children. And the extent of the injuries, the scale and magnitude and severity, especially in terms of burns, is also something that I've not borne witness to before. We had an approximately 11-year-old girl whose face was completely charred black and her arms were flexed and contractured and sort of waxy because the burns had penetrated all the way down to the very flesh and of her. And the smell of burnt flesh permeated the entire emergency room and will stay with me for a very long time.
Dr. Seema Jalani, we only have a minute, but if you could say, it's already so unbearable to just hear accounts of what you're saying. Why do you do this work, and what has it been like for you from one war zone to the next, and now in a place like Gaza, as you say, where you've never seen so many children in an emergency room of a hospital?
It is the absolute honor and privilege of my life to be able to be let into people's moments, whether they are tragic moments of death and pain or whether they are a new baby being born and counseling a new mother on breastfeeding. It is the absolute honor of my life to serve the people of Gaza. And I am so lucky to have served alongside these towering heroes that are nurses and doctors and people that are serving their communities. And that's why we'll keep going back and keep doing this work. And on the flip side of that, I would say it is all of our responsibility to consider those orphans, consider those families who are completely bereft of any and all human dignity that has been taken from them. And it sits with us. Their fate will sit with us.
Dr. Seema Jalani, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Jalani, Senior Technical Advisor at the International Rescue Committee, where she leads their emergency health responses globally. She's recently joined an emergency team of doctors from IRC and Medical Aid for Palestinians who went to central Gaza to volunteer in the Al-Aqsa Hospital. And that does it for today's show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.